Hi, this is Sean and Julia from Sean Sailing's Three Sheets to the Wind, and you are listening to Shooting the Breeze Sailing Podcast from theescapepods.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Shooting the Breeze Sailing Podcast brought to you by theescapepods.com. I'm your host, Captain Jeffrey Wettig. And this episode is episode number 33, at the tail end of August 2015 here. This is actually take number 6, I believe, for the introduction recording. But I thought I was going to get this episode up last Friday, and therefore everything I talked about in the last edition of the intro did not happen. I was planning on going out on a boat this weekend and heading up the Susquehanna River to Lee's Landing. With some peeps from Hans's Point, and that did not happen. We did go out on a boat. We had a great sail on Saturday. Basically, just sailing up and down the Northeast River down to Elkneck and up to just above Red Point, where Pontoon Jim was perched with another friend of ours from high school who had just bought a Bayliner bow rider with his family. They were all anchored up in there. We anchored Pegasus up and dinghied over and hung out for a while, and then we actually, when the other guy left, we pulled the pontoon boat up right up behind Pegasus and just tied it up like it was a big dinghy. And we hung out there for like 3 hours, just, you know, shooting the breeze, swimming, hanging out, doing all that fun stuff. And then we got back to the club right before dark, went out in town, and then had a good night up on the porch playing music with Bob and Laura and a bunch of other people, Captain Tom, my other Captain Tom, his son and a bunch of friends, and Captain Mike and his son Dan, and yeah, there was a good little party going on, and it was a nice night for hanging out on the river and on the bay and on the boat and all that fun stuff. And then Sunday just kind of tooled around on the boat. I did finish a Dodger/Rainfly project that you might have heard me talk about, and I posted a video last week or the week before on when that project was in process. So if you go over to my YouTube channel, just search for Jeffrey Wettig, Sailing Vessel Pegasus, and you'll be able to find that. And I did shoot some more video, and hopefully I'll do a wrap-up of the project. And then I did catch some video when we went out sailing, because I actually sailed down, like I said, to Elkneck, turned around, and I actually sailed onto my anchor when we anchored there. And so hopefully I got some good video of that, and then some good video of the sunset as the day ended. So look for those videos on YouTube. But yeah, I finished that project more or less. You know, I could still tweak it a little bit if I want to, but proved the concept that it works and it fits together pretty nice. I'm just waiting for a piece of track to show up, because of course when I was fitting the track the other day on Wednesday when I was down, you know, I kind of had one piece in one hand, another piece on the other hand, and I said, you know what, don't drop it. And about 4.6 seconds later, I ended up dropping the one piece, and it went plunk in the water. So I just about cried after that, because then I had to postpone finishing up the whole project the way I wanted to and order a new piece of track from Sailrite, which, you know, it only costs like $8, but then it costs another $8 to ship it, and now I'm still waiting for that piece of track to show up, and it's going to be, what, another week or so before I get down there to really finish this off right and get it done. But yeah, I put it all together. I cut the other piece of track I had left in half, so there's half a piece of track on each side to hold this thing up. But it worked. Puts the grommets in. Everything's cinched down pretty good. So it'll definitely protect me from... basically, it's more for wind and rain when it's inclement weather out or it's chilly out. And a lot of it is for at anchor, because I want to be able to keep my hatch open, especially in the summer when it's hot and sticky and I need as much air moving as I possibly can. I want to be able to keep my main companionway hatch open, and this Rainfly Dodger thing will do that pretty well. And it'll work as a spray dodger too if I'm out in rough weather. It'll hold up to probably 30 knot winds. I don't know about much above that. So anyway, that project is done. We did that on Sunday, and I actually bought some stuff down at Bacon the other day when I went down, and I was going to try and fool with my spinnaker, and it just didn't feel like I had enough time to really sail out and do that, so we'll leave that for another day. And I got to get another end for the spinnaker pole that I bought anyway, the clasp is stuck, and I mean, I can beat on it with a hammer and get it to open, but and close. But other than that, I put a bunch of penetrating oil in there, figured maybe that would open it up, and it didn't. So I'm going to have to buy a new end before I do that anyway. So, and then the other thing we did was stopped to look at a 1978 Bayfield 32 cutter that is located right between Northeast Maryland and Elkton. It's Captain Ken Henry. He's got a website, kenhenrymarinesurvey.com. He's been in the business forever. I guess he was in the Navy and served on patrol boats down in Aberdeen. And he's been a surveyor and working on boats for forever. He runs a business called Captain Phineas McHenry Limited. And like I said, he's located in Northeast. And this is a project boat. It's really neat on the website. You can look. He's got before and after pictures of when he purchased the boat to fix it up and how it looks now that he's done with it. And it looks really nice. The price just came down, which kind of prompted me to go down and really look at it. I wanted to get a feel for the interior, the dimensions, the space, and all that kind of stuff. And he did a really nice job putting this thing, taking it apart, putting it back together. He put a new floor, new sole in, new table, new cushions, new stove. It's pretty nice. And if you look, go over to YouTube and look up Sailing Nervous. He actually looks at this boat in one of his episodes because he's looking to buy a liveaboard. And I don't think this is quite a liveaboard, but it'd be a great one for extended cruising, especially on the bay, or if you wanted to, you know, by reputation, the Bayfields are good Great Lakes boats and probably good island boats. And somebody actually did sail one of these things single-handedly back and forth across the Atlantic back in the 80s. So they're nice boats. They're pretty stout. And like this boat in particular that Captain Ken has, you know, I think it's worth the money. I don't think I would go down there and try and lowball them for what it's worth. I mean, he's got all the sails. He spruced it up nice in the inside. He did, you know, some of the systems that were on it were old and beat up and ready to be replaced. And he did not replace some of them, like the refrigeration and the auto helm and that kind of thing. But it's a good looking boat. If anybody's out there looking for a Bayfield 32, you know, go down and check it out. We had a great conversation. I want to get him to come on the podcast at some point. And I'm not saying I'm not in the market for a Bayfield 32. There's actually one other one I want to investigate further, only because it seems like it's too good to be true. So it may be too good to be true and I probably won't go for it. But if it's as advertised for the price they want, it's got a lot of extras and things like that. If I can work the deal, maybe we'll take care of it. I don't know. I'm very torn because Pegasus is a great boat. Pay ships, pretty sturdy for the bay. Not really an ocean going vessel, but I could probably do the islands on it, but it's just more a comfort. When I was, when I first bought it, you know, it was obviously bigger than my other boat. And, you know, it's got a lot of creature comfort for a 26-footer, but it is a 26-footer, and you get two people or three people and all of their stuff, and it gets kind of cramped. And if you're looking to do any kind of extended cruising, I went out for 12 days on it by myself, and obviously I was fine because it was just me, but you get another person or another two people or whatever on it, and you're kind of falling all over each other and can't get out of each other's way. And you know, the Bayfield 32, it's actually a 30. They add to 2 feet for the bowsprit, but it is bigger. It's wider, so you got more space in between. It's set up with a dinette, and the V-berth is a little bit bigger. You can kind of sit up in it, and the dinette's nice, and it's got its own kind of galley separate away from everybody else, and it still has the quarter berth in the rear that kind of opens up into a nav station if you want it to. So you could actually get some decent sea berth there. You get a double berth in the cabin. It's got good ventilation, and obviously it's a cutter rig. It's a little more displacement, so it's a heavier boat. It's well constructed. They say it doesn't go to wind necessarily as well as a fin keel would go, but it tracks nice when you're a little off the wind. And like one guy said, you know, fast, you know, it's not a racing boat. It's set up for cruising. And he said when he goes cruising on the Great Lakes, they, you know, they all leave at the same time and they all get to the same place around the same time and drop their anchors. So it can't be that slow. So we're still sort of in the market for looking at one of these things. I don't know. We'll see. I'm torn. But anyway, back to this episode, episode number 33. We got to talk to Franz Amundsen. He runs MedSailor.com and the Sailing in the Mediterranean podcast, which I'm sure many of you have already listened to. If you're into sailing podcasts, you know, he's one of the upper echelon pods if you want to listen to it. He's got about 50 or 60 episodes, and he also does audiobook style learning guides for the ASA classes that you can purchase on iTunes. And, you know, from what he says, you know, they're a really good resource for people that are looking to get into sailing. You know, there's his audience, you know, he says are a lot of people that are listening to these podcasts are people that are dreaming about sailing and wanting to get into sailing and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So that's a great way to do it if you're looking to go the ASA track and get certified to bareboat and all that kind of stuff. Definitely check out his study guides for that. And even just the 101 is a lot of terminology and nomenclature. So if, you know, people are talking about cutter rigs or whatever, foresails and trisails, you know, 101 study guide goes through all that vocabulary and kind of get used to the way people talk when they're talking about sailing. But I wanted to talk to Franz for a long time. I started listening to his podcast last year. I haven't listened to all of them, obviously, but enough of them to keep my interest. And, you know, a lot of times he talks about one of them, he was talking about his ancestry a little bit right about the time I was getting into Ancestry.com. So it's pretty cool. And basically what he does is he's got a 32-foot channel cutter over in the Mediterranean. It's been there for the last 15, 18 years. He's from Salt Lake City. He sailed it, built it himself the same time he was building a cabin and like a vacation home. He ended up sailing it up in the northwestern United States, up around above Seattle and the islands up there, San Juan Islands, I guess. And at one point then he had it trucked across the country to Portsmouth, Virginia. And he sailed it across the Atlantic and into the Mediterranean, and it's been there ever since, kind of playing musical marinas, trying to keep away from paying taxes on it. So he's spent a lot of time in Turkey and the like, and right now it's over there. He was just there for a month or 2 months earlier this year. So it's really great to talk to him, and you really wanted to pick his brain as far as how do you handle, like, remote maintenance issues and having a boat that far away, and how do you handle commissioning it every year and decommissioning it, and some of the particulars of sailing around the islands over there and where he's been and where he wants to go. So definitely check him out, www.medsailor.com. And thanks for Franz. You know, it's great to cross podcast with him. I interviewed him for this, he interviewed me for his, and we're going to try and get it up around the same time here. So I think sometime soon, either this week or next, he'll be posting his episode with me, and I'm going to try and get this up today on Monday before September starts. But definitely check out Franz, and thanks to him for sitting down and Skyping with me, and we'll catch you on the flip side. Franz, is it Amundsen?
Amundsen.
Amundsen. All right, Franz Amundsen. And Franz runs a sailing podcast called Sailing in the Mediterranean. And that's over at www.medsailor.com. And basically, Franz, you keep your boat in the Mediterranean year-round, and then you basically go visit it. Is that correct?
That's pretty much correct. Yes, I hop up on a plane, fly over, go sail for a month or two, and then come home and put it up on the hard and come home. So
okay, and you're located in Salt Lake City, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So how did you? So you do this podcast, and you've been sailing in the Mediterranean for about 15 years. And how did you get started though with sailing? Like, were you a kid? Was it something you grew up with?
Well, it was one of those things that. And I've repeated this story so many times, so if anybody's listened to me before, it's when I was a kid growing up, there was a guy by the name of Robin Graham, who was sailing around the world on a 27-foot Catalina, and he was 16 years old, and National Geographic did basically a multi-part series of his travels around the world as his kid grew up and sailed around the world and the problems he had. It just captured my imagination. And, wow. And from then out, I just wanted to travel by sailboat. Now, I was living in Utah and then Indiana at the time, so I'd never even been anywhere near the ocean, but it was still always a dream of mine. And, I never gave up that dream.
Right.
And along the way, there's only so many things you can do when you, first of all, don't have the opportunity to sail. Nobody in my family sailed. My great-great-grandfather was actually a sea captain out of Denmark, but that goes way back.
Wow,
but, yeah. So I always had the dream, and I always had wanderlust. I always wanted to travel, and I never really had that much opportunity to travel as a child. My family just didn't have the means for it.
Right.
And when I got married, I told my wife, or when I was dating my wife, I told my dream. And she said, oh, that sounds great. That sounds fine. And eventually, she knew of my desire to go sailing, and she went to a book club one time. And of course, along the way, I'm reading every book you can possibly find on sailing, any narrative or anything I can find to read on sailing. And I passed the ham radio license. This is back when you had to have code, and I became a ham radio. So I prepared myself as much as I could prepare myself without actually ever getting on the water. Uh-huh. And then my wife went to a book club one night. I think it was a book club. And she came back. She says, one of the wives of the book club, her husband's a sailor out on the Great Salt Lake, and he's looking for crew. Wow. And I said, well, geez, I want to get on the crew. So that's where I learned to sail, was on the Great Salt Lake on a racing crew. And my skipper, Mike Seedahl, was probably the best mentor I could ever have. We started out on a Wilderness 30, a really tippy racing boat. And then we went on to trying to remember the name of the boat. Anyway, and a 40-foot boat. And then we went up to a German Freres, I think 47-foot boat.
Wow.
And so he was upgrading all the time, and he was putting new money into all the gear you could possibly put new money into. And we had a pretty good crew. And as time went on, I made all my mistakes in a relatively short period at somebody else's expense. And that's what I tell people all the time. I said, people that want to go sailing, they think they got to go buy a boat. They got to go charter a boat, and it's expensive and it's beyond their ability. And I say, that's nonsense. All you've got to do is get off your butt, go down to a yacht club when they're having a race, and just go up to the race committee and say, hey, is anybody looking for crew? And you know as well as I do that your crew doesn't show up, and you're shorthanded, and you're always, you're looking for crew, because there was never a single person that ever showed up to our yacht club looking for a position that wasn't snapped up. So that's what I tell people. Say, you want to learn to sail, get off your butt and go down to a yacht club and tell them you want to get on a crew. And once you get on a crew, you'll be invited back, as long as you don't ruin everything.
Don't want to be all thumbs,
Right. There's sometimes people discover that they're not cut out for it by themselves. And it's better to discover that early on rather than live this dream and suddenly realize, I really don't enjoy this much.
No doubt. So sailing on the Salt Lake, how big, honestly, I'd never even really thought about it. How big is this Great Salt Lake? I mean, if you're sailing almost 50 footers on the Great Salt Lake, it's got to be pretty big. And then what's the, how's it different from sailing? I mean, is it closer to sailing in the ocean in terms of the way the water reacts?
Well, the Great Salt Lake, we eventually had to pull out Mike's big boat because the water level of the Great Salt Lake dropped.
Right.
And you don't think of tides on the Great Salt Lake, but they're about 15-year tides. You know, the water level comes up and the water level goes down, depending on the depending on the weather cycles. And it's about, I'd say probably about 40 miles wide by 50. Well, it's almost 100 miles. I'd say about 90 miles long from one end to the other end. But halfway through the lake, there's a causeway, a railroad causeway that separates the lake. And it's about 30 feet deep.
Okay.
At the deepest part. So it's a shallow lake. It's high density water because it's very salinic.
Right.
And it's not a place I'd go to just to hang out, but some people do. it was great for racing. And you really only do two types of racing on the Great Salt Lake. It's either very light air racing, so it's just catching zephyrs, so you learn to do light air sailing, or it's very heavy air because the weather will come in off the desert and slam you almost instantaneously. I mean, when a weather pattern hits from the desert, it comes in hard and fast. So you learn to deal with both of the extremes of sailing. It's not like tropical weather sailing or trade wind sailing where it's nice, consistent breezes. It's usually one or the other. And so for that reason, I think those are the two hardest things to learn in sailing is the extremes. Anybody can sail in trade winds, but it's the extremes that are hard to sail with. And because it's such a salinic, shallow lake, you get very, very steep, square waves that will just pound you. And we've had people on the boat that have never been seasick in their life get seasick on the Great Salt Lake. So, you know, you're not going to get the big 30-foot, 20-foot rollers that you'll get in the Atlantic, but you get plenty of short, nasty, square waves that bounce you around pretty heavily. So
it's like trial by fire.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah. Yeah. We had a very active racing group. We would have, I think, Thursday night races, around the buoy races. And then on weekends, we would usually have at least one day on weekends, there'd be a race. Uh-huh. And when I got on the crew, I would go to every race. And that's why I became a valued crew member and, you know, learned all the positions on the boat. And so that's how I learned how to sail. Now, I always knew that this was a means to an end. I was going to learn to sail, but my goal was to become a cruising sailor. Mm-hmm. And so during this period of time when I was racing, I was I was gathering up wheel weights from tire shops. I was reading everything I could on building boats. And when you know, we talked earlier and you said you had seen West Sails. I remember Frederick Mate wrote a book, Building Your Own Boat, about building your own boat. Uh-huh. And I bought his book and I thought, you know, I can't afford the kind of boat that I want to have. I want a boat that'll take me around the world.
Right.
And I realized there was no way I would save up enough money or have the income to afford a boat like that. So I said, well, I've got to build my boat.
Okay.
And so I eventually bought a Holland Deck from Sam Moore's company, a Bristol Channel Cutter Holland Deck, which was one of the last that he sold.
Okay.
And took 5 years to finish that boat. And then I launched it up in I launched in Bellingham, Washington, and spent 5 years sailing up in the Northwest. And then eventually moved it across the country and sailed from Hampton, Virginia to Spain. And then through the Straits of Gibraltar, and have been in the Mediterranean since 1997.
Okay. So you started building this thing in early 90s then?
Oh, geez. It would have been – yeah, it took me about 5 years to build the boat. So let's go backwards. So I was sailing up in the Northwest for 5 years, so that would take me down to 92. And so it would have been about 85, 86 that I bought the boat and spent 5 years building the boat and then launched it.
Did
so
you, did you have like a home workshop kind of thing, or were you building it in a yard? Like how did that, what was the logistics of that?
Yeah. My wife and I, when we got married, we bought a house and in an area in Salt Lake, in the Avenue section of Salt Lake, which is known for very small yards. Uh-huh. But it just so happened that it had a long, narrow lot
Okay.
And behind my garage, I had enough space to put up a boat shed.
Okay.
And so I poured a pad and had the hull delivered and then built the shed up around it.
There you go.
And I'd recommend this to anybody trying to build a boat. Get the boat out of the weather. You got to put a cover on that boat because, you know, right. If you spend any time like I did, it'll be ruined by the elements before as you done. Can build it. Yes. So I had a nice enclosed shop, and I would typically work on the boat only in the winters because my wife's dream was to have her summer home, and I was building the summer home in the summer. Now, I mean physically building the boat. I'm not hiring people to do this and building the summer home. I'm physically building the summer home. Now, my job is I'm a financial consultant, or I'm a registered investment advisor. So I'm working at a desk all the time, but I get a tremendous amount of satisfaction by creating something with my hands. So to me, it was almost like therapy.
Okay.
I enjoyed the building process thoroughly. There would be times I'd be working on the boat in the middle of the winter and I'd say, geez, I could go skiing or I could do this. And I'd think, you know what? I'm so happy just doing this. So it's so nice to create something to me that I enjoyed that. So,
well, that's awesome. Because I mean, the project is the biggest part of getting started. So you have to enjoy that part. If you don't,
mm-hmm. Yeah. If all you're looking at is the end goal, then you're not going to be happy. Because to me, it took 5 years, and during that period of time, I thought, well, even if I could launch the boat, I couldn't afford to keep it in the marina right now. But when I needed money for an engine, it seemed to show up. And when I needed some expertise, somehow I would find the right person. It's almost supernatural, the things that occur once you start down a path that that you're going for. I mean, if you, this is kind of bizarre to think about, but you start down a path of something you really, truly want.
Right.
Somehow things appear that seem to push you in that direction. So that's been my experience.
There's something out there that's getting you home. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's like, you can dream about all you want, but until you actually start doing something, nothing ever happens. So.
Right. So how long did it take to build the house?
About the same time. I'd work on the cabin in the summer and the boat in the winter, and we paid for it as we went along. So we were saving money. So when I had the boat done, it was paid for and didn't owe any money on it. And, it's a beautiful boat. I'm very proud of the work I did on it. And it's an extremely seaworthy boat. The boat's never been in doubt, only the crew.
Oh, yeah. The boat will handle a whole lot more than the crew will. That's been my experience anyway. And I know I've got one particular listener, Kamau, who's probably very interested in your story because he's building a boat in his backyard. Same thing, long skinny house, long skinny lot, and he's built, he's already built the strong back, and he's putting a roof on that now because he laid out the keelson. And
so he's building it from wood then, huh?
He's building it, plywood, epoxy, and he's a project manager, like a senior project manager for a construction. Well, he has his own construction firm, I guess, works for other construction as a consultant. So he's not, he's definitely familiar with building large things, not necessarily boats, but, and he's kind of thinking maybe he can use some non-traditional production methods and materials to build this boat. And, he's got it all laid out. If you find him on YouTube, his name's Kamau, Kamau, Ian.Tierro, which is more than I can handle spelling at this moment. But if you search on YouTube, you'll find him. And he gives like little 5-10 minute updates. And this summer basically was to lay out the keelson and get the strong back up. So he's got that done. And then now next year he'll start putting the braces in and doing whatever he's doing. But can you even, I guess my question for you is like, even now, can you even buy a hull deck kind of scenario like you did?
I'm sure there's companies that'll sell them, but you're going to have to do some searching for it. I don't know if Westsail was one of the two big ones that did it way back when.
Okay.
And And the reason I chose not to go with the West Sail is I just read some reviews on it, and it just didn't sail to wind very well.
Right.
And then, of course, the parties came out and talked about cruising in Seraphim and the Lyle Hess design, and and this is basically the equivalent of the boat they have, very close to the boat they have, except theirs is out of wood and mine's out of fiberglass. And and so I found Sam Moore's company in Costa Mesa, California. I went down there. Sam arranged me to go out with a gentleman by the name of Doug Schmuck. To take me out sailing on his boat, which his boat's name was Puffin. Now, Doug took off sailing in his boat, ended up down in New Zealand, and immigrated down to New Zealand, and lives very close to where Larry and Lynn Party do, down in the Bay of Islands. So, Doug became a good friend of mine. I'd go sailing with him, and I love the boat. It's not a big creature comfort boat, but it's a very seaworthy boat. So
it's what, a 32 foot?
No, it's 28 feet on deck, 37 feet overall.
I got you. And then I was watching some of your videos that you have on your website, like dealing with the hand steering, or the wind vane that you built. So, I mean, you're basically going full out with building all this stuff yourself.
Yeah, and there's a guy by the name of Mike Anderson that makes that wind vane, and he's a good friend of mine, and we've traded design ideas back and forth.
Right.
And if you're not handy, and if you're not, it might be better to buy that, because there's a little bit of intricacy to it, but not that much, you know. It's, but I do enjoy building. I like to have projects, and if I don't have a project, I'm really usually not very happy. So.
Right. It sounds like you're definitely mechanically inclined enough to really get in there and understand construction and kind of the technical, you know, how things fit together and all that kind of stuff. Because I watched your wind vane video, and I still have no idea how you built it. I mean, I see how it was done, but I can't quite see it in my head. I'm not quite as technical as you. You know, I would have to buy mine.
Yeah. Well, once you see it working, sometimes it all comes together after you watch it working. But but no, I didn't design that. Larry Party pretty much designed that. And I just copied his ideas from that.
Right.
And Mike Anderson pretty much makes it commercially. Mike lives in Newport Beach, California. And I think his name is called the book. It's called Freehand, but that wind vane would not work on most boats.
Right. You have to have a cable or a rudder or a aft-hung rudder, right?
Right. Aft-hung rudder and then a backstay that you could pivot the vane on.
I got you. Right. So on your website, like you do the podcast, but you also do like study guides for the American Sailing Association classes that you can pretty much take anywhere that a sailing school in the U.S. is going to be ASA certified. So you do these study guides. They're kind of like an audio book that you can listen to and then help study for the exams. Did you yourself go that track to learn sailing?
No, I didn't go that track. I went, in fact, I don't have any ASA certifications at all. I have a commercial Coast Guard license. I'm a master.
Okay.
So I don't need, you know, I think that's way beyond the ASA requirements.
Right.
I'm not too concerned about the ASA requirements. And when I've sailed overseas, nobody questions that license.
Right. Well, did you get at what point in your sailing did you get that license? Was it while you're still racing or while you had your boat up in the Northwest, or was it while you were in the Mediterranean?
Well, I actually passed a six-pack license while I was still racing. I got enough hours to get the six-pack license, I think, while I was still racing.
Uh-huh.
And then you have to renew it every so often. And then eventually I said, well, let's just upgrade to the full-on commercial master's license, Coast Guard officer's license.
Did you do that, I mean, just to learn it, or were you looking at maybe starting a business, or what was the real motivation behind that?
Just for kicks.
Just for kicks.
Yeah. Just for
another
kicks.
Project, right?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a pretty serious examination. It's a 2-day examination.
Right.
And I had to travel to take the examination. I live in Salt Lake, and the testing center was down in Long Beach, California. So I had to go down there for 2 days of examination, and it's not a test to sneeze at. And before you can even take the test, you have to show a huge number of hours on the water.
Right, right.
And you have to have background check done on you by the FBI and fingerprinted and all this other stuff. And now you have this whole transfer TWIC card, the Transportation Workers ID card that you have to go down for. It's a real bureaucratic headache to even sit for the exam.
Right, but, yeah. Learn everything.
Yeah, much less learn everything. So you have to have multiple, you know, I think 365 days of on the water experience in the last 5-year period of time to even sit for the examination. So you have to have a lot of sea time before you can take the examination.
Right. So, but you can take the examination without actually taking any classes. Is that correct?
Right. Anybody can take the examination.
If
you can pass the examination and you have the sea time and you qualify to take it, anybody can do it. You don't have to have any classes.
Because, I mean, I've interviewed other people like from the sailing schools around the Chesapeake and, you know, they all offer the captain's license kind of track, you know what I mean? And I've often thought about, maybe that's something I would like to do, because I see a bunch of – every time you go to Annapolis or any of these bigger cities, you know, the guys that are running the water taxis or the guys that are running the pump out boats, you know, most of them are retired guys, you know, just goofing off for the summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the guys I raced with runs the taxi service on Chicago. You know, he runs a
– Okay.
Exactly, and that's exactly what he did. He retired and he wanted to play around on boats. And so he passed a captain's license and now he's in charge of the water taxi service that goes between Navy Pier and all the other places, and also the tour boats that go up and down the Chicago River.
Wow.
Conrad Rickoff is his name. And I met him doing the Newport Ensenada race 1 year and we became friends, and I did the Chicago to Mackinac Island race with him a couple times. So,
oh, wow. That's awesome. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just interviewed a guy that does, another YouTube guy, Sean Bachmaster. He bought a boat up in Lake Huron, and he's kind of right now in the middle of a summer-long cruise going around Lake Huron and that whole Upper Peninsula area. So pretty interesting places. I just wanted to ask you this because of the whole ASA thing. Can you tell when you're talking to a sailor if they've been through the ASA or not?
I couldn't tell, but I mean, I can tell if they know what they're talking about, I mean, you know, my courses are audio courses and they're not going to prepare you to sail.
Right.
That's what I tell people. These are courses that are basically just designed to help you pass the written portion of the examination.
I got you.
It's not for the on the water sailing. You better damn well get your sailing experience if you're going to
put your time in, right?
That's right. You can't learn to sail by reading a book.
Book, exactly, right. And it took me, because I kind of bought my own boat, and I had a friend introduce me to it, and he was like, "Oh, you've got the nose for the wind, you got it." So I was like, "All right, maybe I should look into doing this." So when I bought my boat, it was basically training by yacht club committee. Now, who wants to take me out, and then who wants to come out with me to make sure I don't crash into all the other boats for about the first 5 months, and then finally I had the gumption enough to actually go out solo on my own and just even just to sail around the little part of the river that I'm in. I mean, my heart's racing, and you know what I mean. I had to catch the mooring by myself, and I think it's important that people, if they're going to do any kind of cruising or have their own boat, you need to know how to handle it yourself. So once you get beyond the introduction to sailing and you kind of get your feet wet, if you're going to own a boat, I think it's important that you need to be able to handle it yourself.
I agree. I usually in the summer when I go sailing, I'll give myself about a week just to do some solo sailing. It's always challenging. And the hardest part of solo sailing is not to get out there in the open water and go sailing. It's coming in and out of port.
Port, exactly.
It's really the white knuckle stuff. Because how are you going to, tie off your bow line? How are you going to tie off your stern line? How are you going to get all these places that normally you have four people doing
it? Right. Yeah. Yeah. You wish you had the six extra pair of hands.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you've been, in the Mediterranean now for since 97, you said?
Yeah, that's when I sailed across.
So that's 18 years.
Jeez.
So have you gone everywhere in the Mediterranean in 18 years or not?
Well, let's see. I haven't been up in France and northern Italy on the west coast. I've been all the way along the coast of Spain, out the Balearics, Sardinia. Haven't been to the southern part of Sardinia, except by train. Been through most of the islands, the Italian islands, but there's a few Italian islands I haven't been through.
Okay.
And I haven't been north of Gaeta, Italy. So that whole area up there I've been to. Let's see. I haven't been to Venice and sort of that northwest section of the Adriatic. But other than that, I've pretty much covered it all. I haven't been around. I've been only as far east as Antalya, Turkey. And I haven't been up into the Black Sea yet. I've been up to the Sea of Marmara, but I've pretty much covered almost all the Greek islands except for the Peloponnese. I haven't been around the Peloponnese yet. And I've covered most of that territory, but I've been thinking pretty seriously this summer of heading up into the Black Sea. I interviewed a man for the last couple of my podcasts, a man from Romania that has a sailboat up there. There's very little information on the Black Sea.
Right.
And I thought, well, before I start heading back west through the Mediterranean, I was actually thinking about heading to Malta next year. And I thought, you know what, before I start heading west, let's do one last, I'm thinking, now I haven't made my mind up for sure yet, but I'm thinking of heading up into the Black Sea and just doing Bulgaria and Romania and visit the Danube Delta before I head west again.
Yeah, I listened to the first episode. I didn't listen to the one you just released. But he basically said that's about as far as you get before it gets kind of sticky. Is that correct?
Yeah, you don't want to get into Ukraine and Russia and those areas. That might be a little touchy up there, but that's probably as far as I'd go in the Black Sea. Now, I took a bus along the entire coast of Turkey from Trabzon all the way across the Black Sea in northern Turkey, just on the land, because I wanted to go check it out from the land. Uh-huh. And I decided I did not want to take my boat into the north of Turkey,
because
it just didn't seem like there was much to see there, quite honestly. So I thought, well, I won't take my boat up to the north of Turkey. But maybe Bulgaria and Romania would be sort of interesting.
So now, where is your boat currently?
Bodrum, Turkey right now.
Okay. And to get to the Danube Delta there, how long of a trip would that be?
I haven't laid it out, but it's probably going to be it's probably going to be a good 2 solid weeks just to get up to Istanbul.
Uh-huh.
And from Istanbul, it'd be another 3 or 4 days to work my way up there. Once I get through the Bosphorus, I'd have to head on up that way. Yeah.
So then would you keep the boat up there then once you get there and it kind of make a multi-year thing, or would you try and do all that in one shot?
Well, I think if I do that, I'll probably bring my boat back to Istanbul. And but I haven't made my mind up yet. It just depends on the logistics and the timing of it, how long it takes. There's some marinas on the Sea of Marmara, just southeast of Istanbul, that are pretty good marinas, and they're the Setter Marina chain, and I might just leave it there.
Right.
I like to pull my boat out of the water when I leave, so I don't have to worry about it.
Right. So I was going to say, basically every year you spend, what, a month, 2 months?
Usually 2 months. This year was 1 month. But normally it's about 2 months.
And is this always at the same time of year, like early spring, or?
Well, it depends on where I'm trying. You know, if I'm trying to go north, I want to go the 1st of May because you still have southerlies blowing at the 1st of May.
Okay.
But once you get into June and July, the southerlies turn into strong northerlies.
Right.
And if you're trying to go north, it becomes difficult to go north.
Right.
This is weather patterns called the Maltemis, and when the Maltemis are blowing, it's very difficult to work your way north. So if I'm heading north, then I try to leave fairly early in the year, May, and maybe the 1st of June you can start working your way north. And after that, it becomes difficult to work your way north. And you know, these people that do these charters in the Aegean, it's easy to go south,
Right.
And it's sometimes hard to go north. So I always recommend if people are in the Aegean doing a charter, you know, spend most of your time working your way north, because you can always slide home, but you may not be able to go home if you're south and have to work your way north.
Right. And these Maltimi winds, I mean, they're kind of almost billed as almost like Williwaws. I mean, they're sometimes very severe winds. Is that not correct?
Yeah, I've been stuck in port for 3, 4, or 5 days at a time, just because it's just no fun to go out and be in these winds. So.
Right. And now, is that basically like atmosphere? Like, is that like following a low pressure? Like, kind of on the East Coast, you can kind of predict these things a little bit when like a low pressure system goes by. It's going to fill in behind it for a day or two. Is it kind of the same situation, or is it more of something to do with the geography?
Now, the Maltimis are a summer weather pattern that are built up as a result of, these are big global weather systems. There's a weather pattern over the Azores called the Azores High, mm-hmm. which is moving in a clockwise direction. And then there's a Pakistani Low, which is in a counterclockwise direction. And they meet right. at the in the Aegean.
Okay.
And so that's why the winds tend to blow northeast, north, northwest, because that moves back and forth. And some days it's very, very strong, and other days it's not. It can be perfectly clear, and you'll have, 30, 40 knot winds blowing.
Wow.
And it's beautiful. It's nice. As long as you're on the land, it doesn't bother you. People right. are going vacation on the land. That's a refreshing wind because it's so hot. But
right.
if you're trying to go anywhere on a boat, it becomes difficult. Now, the Aegean, which is just a little ways to the west, you don't have these weather patterns. The weather patterns of the Aegean are totally different than the Adriatic. The weather patterns in the Adriatic are entirely different than right. the Aegean. In the summer, they tend to still come from the north, but not for days at a time like you will in the Aegean. So,
right. Yeah, we get kind of this, like I said, the same kind of thing in the Chesapeake in usually early spring. But I don't know how many Mother's Days where I was like, you know what, we're going to go out for Mother's Day. And, you know, it's perfectly fine, a little breezy where you're at. You get down into the bay and it's just blowing like snot. And you can't even get to the boat in the dinghy without getting soaked. And you're like, you know what, I think we're going to skip it. And, you know, we'll do this next time. And then you do it the following year, and the same thing happens. It's like, okay, you get these 25, 30 knot blows coming out of the northwest for 2, 3 days, you know, till the low or the high or whatever the gradient passes, and then finally it calms down. But
mm-hmm. yeah,
it's no fun to be, you know. I mean, if you're really looking for some excitement, and then go sailing during those winds, you know. If not, yeah, if you're just looking for a nice day sail, just stay home, you know.
Yeah. You know, and in the Maltimis, you can always make your way south. Like I say, you can always put the small sail out and just sort of glide down.
But
the waves will be pretty big, so they'll be kicking you around a little bit. But you can always go south. But, boy, if you want to turn around and go north, it's going to be a miserable trip going north.
Right. So, okay, so in 18 years, you've been most of the way through there's a couple spots. Are you planning on hitting those spots on the way? Like, you're going to kind of do another kind of back through the other side of the Mediterranean, or what's your like 5-year plan?
Well, I don't really have a 5-year plan. I sort of work it a year at a time, but I've been up to Croatia. I spent 5 years in Croatia and I haven't done, the northwestern part of the Adriatic, Venice. Haven't done really a little bit of Asturias, but I haven't done some of those northern Aegean. And I may or may not head back up there. I'm not sure yet. But the problem I have is, and I complain about this all the time, is the VAT situation in Europe. If you're a foreign boat, you have 18 months that you can spend in the EU waters without paying VAT.
Right.
After that, you have to pay VAT. So I'm always cognizant of how long I can spend in European waters without paying VAT. And at some point in time,
right,
I may just bite the bullet and pay VAT, or maybe right. maybe one of these countries, maybe the VAT will blow up. I won't hold my breath on that, but I don't see it. I may just pay the VAT because boats don't get more valuable. They get less and less valuable with time. And my boat's getting to be a pretty old boat. So.
Right. And what kind of tax is that?
Yeah, it's like 25% of the value of the boat.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Stay clear.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, when my boat was new, that would be a big hit with being an old boat. It's not as big a hit. And maybe at some point in time, they'll just say, hey, it's just too old. We're not even going to collect a tax on it. I don't know.
Right.
But I'd actually like to get up in the Baltic. After talking to Andy Schell, I'm thinking, well, you know, I'd like to do the French canals. I'd like to do the Baltic, as Andy made the Baltic sound pretty interesting. So, and I'm only up there in the summer, so I'm not worried about the miserable winters they have up there.
Right. And because you're only there in the, you know, you've only got a month or two. Like, how long of a that would be a multi-year thing, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd work my way east. You know, I'm not a big long distance sail. I mean, when I did the transatlantic, that was fine, but I like to sleep in a nice calm anchorage. I sleep a lot better when I'm not being bounced around on a boat. So
I am definitely with you on that one. And that's why, you know, like, honestly, like, being in the middle of the ocean kind of intrigues me, but it probably scares me just as much as it intrigues me. But I know it's probably going to be a big pain in the ass and annoying, and that's probably worse than the other two, you know. So I don't know if I'll ever do that, but definitely the Baltic Sea, and I would be interested to go up there because that's where my family roots are from. I know you've talked on your podcast about your family roots, and you're more Central Europe, is that correct?
No, I'm probably about 80% Scandinavian, mostly Danish.
Oh, wow.
And a little bit of German.
Okay.
So that's where my name Franz comes from, is my great-grandfather. So it was the German side of the family. So definitely Northern European. So
yeah, same here. Most of mine are from Upper Germany and Poland, around the Neustadt area, which is, you know, basically all of my family, to save for one part, is all within probably 200 miles or 100 miles definitely of the Baltic Sea, but within 200 or 300 miles of each other. You know what I mean? So, like, through Lithuania and northern Poland and into Germany. And I was, you know, I'd always heard that, but, you know, until I actually got on Ancestry.com and did it. But what kind of really freaked me out, I didn't realize most of my family's been here since the 1700s. So
you're an old pilgrim then, huh?
Yeah, definitely. And, I mean, one part of my family did come over in the late 1800s from Poland, but the rest of them are already here. And a lot of them ended up in coal mines and things like that up in the central part of Pennsylvania. So, but I would definitely, you know, Andy talked about sailing in the Baltic Sea, and I would, you know, I don't even, you know, I'd like to just go there and pull around on land, you know what I mean? And then maybe charter a boat or something like that someday.
That's right. Someday, you know, it's amazing. You can spend some money and charter a boat anywhere in the world now. So it's you don't have to necessarily take your own boat over there to do it.
Exactly. And that's a running joke with me and my better half, is she wants to go somewhere. I go, can you sail there? She's like, no, you have to fly. I'm like, ah, damn it. All right. So your boat basically spends most of its time up on the hard, laid up, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I have a full cover that I put over it. So when I go back, when I go back at the beginning of the year, every year, it's dirty, but it's not weathered. You know, okay. I keep a full cover on it when I'm not there. And that preserves a boat amazingly, just keeping that ultraviolet rays off the boat all the time. So,
okay. Because I wanted to ask you about your maintenance kind of, logistically speaking. I mean, you're halfway around the world, your boat's sitting in a yard somewhere. Like, what kind of maintenance projects have you had to do in the 18 years that you've been over there, and how do you manage that sort of thing?
Well, I have whole podcasts on my problems with refrigeration.
Right? And yeah, go be a refrigeration tech. I've heard you say that.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a great idea. If I were a young man, I'd learn that skill, you know, because you're going to be in demand all the time.
Right?
But Usually I pretty much know what I need to do from year to year. I mean, I built the boat, so there's not much that's going to surprise me on the boat. I replaced the bowsprit a couple of years ago and the boomkin. Those are the two critical wood structure on the boat. That's critical for the rigging.
Right, right.
And I've examined my my rigging, my standing rigging. It's in good shape. I don't need to worry about that. But it's always the fittings that you worry about, because you get these hairline cracks in the fittings. One time I went back to my boat when it was in Ivalik, and I got back to the boat and it was on the hard. Mm-hmm. And the bowsprit, the bobstay, from the haul up to the end of the bowsprit, it was laying on the ground.
Oh, man.
And it was that swedged fitting that fits onto the cable. That was one of the few swedged fittings I had. Most of my rigging is hand spliced, but that was one swedged fitting, and the eye had broken straight through, and you would never have known that that had broken straight through. So I do not trust stainless steel fittings I prefer bronze, but you can't get bronze fittings very easily, so that's always the fear I have. But only alternative, of course, most of my fittings, like I say, are bronze thimble fittings, so I don't have to worry about it. There's only a couple swedge fittings on my boat.
Now, do you for us at the Chesapeake Bay, we don't have a lot of, it's all mostly freshwater, so I don't have to worry too much about that kind of thing. But every year we're painting bottoms and sanding and scraping and all that kind of stuff. I mean, how much time I'm planning for 2 months. How much time do you devote to that kind of thing, or do you get somebody else to do it?
I usually have several projects that I'm trying to take care of when I arrive at the boat. This year, my projects were, I wanted to change the heat exchanger, and I wanted to get my refrigeration working. I didn't care what it took.
Right.
So that took about, I gave myself a full week.
Okay.
To get that done, and that was done in the week. And I only have good things to say about the Turkish workers. So I had a refrigerator mechanic that was Turkish that could not speak English, but his brother could speak English. So he'd get his brother on the phone and would go back and forth, and I'd talk to his brother, and then his brother would talk to him, and he got the refrigeration working just fine. And then the heat exchanger on the engine, I have a Yanmar 30 horsepower engine, which is just a wonderful engine. And I was starting to get overheating problems on this, and I'd change the mixing elbow, and I checked all the pumps, and I'd change the pumps, and I was still getting overheating on it when I was just, not over revving the engine.
Right.
And, I talked to this girl in my parts supplier in California.
Right.
And she said, "Oh, well, when was the last time you cleaned your heat exchanger?" I said, "Well, I've never cleaned my heat exchanger." She said, "Well, that might be the problem." So, so I changed that, and then that took care of the problem right there. So I wasn't overheating at all last year. And this next year I need, my sails on the boat are original sails. I'm probably going to replace my sails next year. That's my project next year. And also one of my hatches needs to be rebuilt. And I've got the guy that rebuilt my bowsprit and boomkin. He's right there next to the yard, and he came over and gave me a bid, and I'll just have him go to do that. And so I devote usually a week, when I get over there to getting the boat ready to go in the water. But I pretty much have it planned out way ahead of time, so I'm not dilly-dallying around the yard. I never understand these people that have these boats that go to the yard and spend a month working on their boat and never go sailing.
What's
the point of that?
Well, it's funny for us in the spring, and this year it was especially bad because, you get into the middle of March and you're starting to think about, all right, you're planning out. And for me, I work every other weekend, so I only have every other weekend free and then maybe a day in the middle of the week to do any kind of project. So it would be nice to have a full week to actually concentrate on doing stuff. But this year it was really bad because, the bay was iced up through the beginning of April. They couldn't turn the water on until the middle of April. So you can't do anything in the yard except maybe take your tarps off and do that kind of stuff. But it's always kind of a struggle because you're like, all right, I'm going to get down there. I'm going to get there at 6 o'clock in the morning. And we're going to go work at the club because we kind of a do-it-ourself kind of club. So we have to put all our docks in. We have to go put all our moorings in, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, Saturday is going to be like from 6 a.m. to 3 or 4 p.m. is working for the club, putting moorings in, all that kind of stuff. And then you get from, you know, maybe 5, 6 o'clock at night till midnight to actually work on your project when it gets dark. Hopefully it's an interior project. And then maybe you get Sunday, you know what I mean, till 3 or 4 o'clock. And you're like, I got to wrap it up and get home. So when you're talking about sanding and painting and you know what I mean, all this stuff's temperature kind of dependent, it gets kind of hairy, because then you're up against, you know, if you're not in the water by Memorial Day, what's the point?
Yeah. Now, when I lay out my summer, I usually lay it out with, I have different crews come over and join me at different times. You know, my family always has first priority.
Right.
And, last year, my wife didn't want to go sailing. She wanted to go visit somewhere else.
Okay.
She wanted to do a different trip because she says, you know, we've been sailing the Mediterranean. I want to go somewhere else for a change. And that's a downside of having a boat, is you don't, you suddenly say, well, geez, I got to go spend my time on the boat, you know, instead of do other things. So she said, I want to go somewhere else. So she wanted to go visit Thailand and Cambodia. So that's what we did over the winter. And she's a the head of a newborn ICU, a big department, a huge department.
Right.
So she doesn't have the flexibility of her schedule that I do. So she has specific time that she can take, and she didn't want to take that time and be on the boat. So me, I could still do it because I'm taking clients with me sailing. So to me, I'm still working as far as I'm concerned.
Right. Right.
But when I lay out my schedule for the summer, I tell people, okay, this is where you're going to meet me. You're going to be with me for, say 5 nights on the boat, and then you're getting off. Then I have a day or two before my next crew while I do the laundry and all the other headaches that you have to deal with.
Right.
And then the next crew arrives. But my put-in crew and my takeout crew, I give them extra time because I'm going to work their tail off. You know, they're going to be painting the bottom of the boat with me, and they're going to be doing all this other stuff. And I make that perfectly clear. So I usually have a couple guys to help me put it in the water, and a couple guys to help me take it out of the water, and they're willing to do that because they get a little extra time on the boat.
Oh,
and
that's awesome.
They're usually friends, and you know, you guys don't mind working. Don't get, you know, if I have somebody on the boat that doesn't,
who's slacking.
If they're not a guy's guy, they're probably not getting on my boat.
Oh, you know? Right. That's so awesome. So how did you, so you've been sailing all this time. How did you get into the whole podcast game?
You know, my partner and I were probably one of the original podcasters when it came out a long time ago. We did a podcast called the Investment Education Podcast, I think is the name of it. And we just started doing it. And my partner sort of lost interest in it because it takes a lot more time than people think it will.
Right.
And we had a free host through a company called Big in Japan. And suddenly one day, and I'm not a tech guy, but suddenly one day the company went out and my RSS feed died, and I didn't know anything about doing it. So it sat idle for a long time.
Right.
But I've always been a big fan of audio. I've always liked audio. I like to listen to the radio rather than watch TV. I'd rather listen to books on tape rather than read a book. I'd rather, you know, I like audio. So, and when I was, when we go way back, I actually studied audio in high school. I belonged to an explore post in South Bend, Indiana that specialized in radio and television broadcasting because it was fun to do.
Oh, yeah.
So I knew all about audio production and somewhat about video production, but mostly audio production because we had a weekly show that we had to put on. And so I decided to start doing it again, and I started another podcast called Travel Trade Exchange, and it got hacked, and I just said forget it, so I shut it down. And then I decided to do another podcast called the Series 7 Podcast, which is a series of lessons to help people prepare for the Series 7 examination. And that one is by far my most popular podcast. Then I thought, well, that's for professionals, that's for people working in the finance industry. Let me do something for fun. And I thought, let's just do what I'm passionate about, which is sailing. So let's just do a Sailing in the Mediterranean podcast. And I'm not sure, but somebody told me, in fact, it was my crew, Jack Andrews, this summer, said, Franz, your podcast is the oldest continuously running podcast on sailing.
Oh, really?
Said, I said, yeah. He said, yes, it is. I said, oh, I don't have as many episodes out, but it's the long, he said, it's now this is not me saying this, this is what he said.
Right.
I don't know how to check these. I don't know how to go back and see if it's the oldest running sailing podcast or not, but he said it was. He says there's been other ones that came and went,
right?
But yours is still continuously running. So there were some older ones out there that there's this guy that was sailing around South Pacific that was doing podcasts on his boat, and he eventually said, okay, I'm done. I'm going done. And so that was the last one he did. But he may have been actually an older podcast, but it's not running anymore.
Right. So what year did you start the sailing podcast?
I couldn't tell you. I'd have to go back and look and tell you.
There you go. Well, I know when I first started thinking about doing it, was in 2010, and I'd been listening to podcasts for about 4 or 5 years at that point. You know, I'd listened to a film podcast called Film Spotting. That was probably my first one. And then I got into a bunch of Kevin Smith, the film director. He has got a whole stable of podcasts that he's either involved with or, you know, produces through his network. And starting in 2007, I think. So I kind of was really into it up until 2010. And then I lost my job and things changed and I didn't have a lot of time to sit around and listen to podcasts. So I'd been kind of thinking about doing a podcast and I was investigating equipment and that kind of thing. And I was thinking about doing a sailing podcast back then and I just kind of let it go. So I didn't pick it up again until like 2013. But when I looked around before, like in 2010, like I said, there was like Furled Sails was one, and I only got through like 2 or 3 episodes because for some reason they just weren't keeping my attention. But now, I mean, there's like, I don't know, there's probably what, 5 or 6 of like what I would consider mainstream podcasts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's about right. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's funny how it kind of developed because it was like I started doing this podcast and then Andy Schell started 5-9 North and we started about the same time. Now, he had done another podcast prior to that called Two Inspired Guys, which I didn't know anything about, but he kept ending up talking to sailors because that's what he was into. So that's why he kind of went the way he did. But we were both doing it in the same time, same place. So that's how that came about. And I didn't really catch yours until last year. And, but then it was funny because, like Andy interviewed the Shards and then you interviewed the Shards and then I interviewed the Shards.
You know, I think we provide a lot of their marketing as the Shards and they're good people to talk to, but you know, that's, yeah, they get a lot of their
traffic
from the podcast. And, right. And the only reason I interviewed the Shards is Dan Culpepper, uh-huh, one of my listeners, he actually came out to Salt Lake and we ended up going skiing. And he said, oh yeah, I have the Shards videos. I said, who are they? And they said, oh, they make videos. I thought, well, let me call them up and see if we can do a podcast. Yeah. So, and they're always great people to interview. I think I've had a couple with them and I'll probably catch up with them again. So.
Right. Oh yeah. It's just funny. Cause like when I interviewed them, I had already listened to yours, I think. And, Andy's. So I'm like, I want to try and interview them about something different. You know what I mean? Like ask different questions. And, you know, I kind of tried to keep it Chesapeake Bay related, but you know, we kind of got off topic. And then since they're so used to talking about stuff, they kind of get into the rhythm and they start talking about the same thing or giving the same kind of spiel. You know what I mean? And it's like, no, I want to talk about this, you know. But, and you've talked to the guy that does the sailing podcast, right?
Right. Oh, what's his name?
I can't.
He always says, this is Josh and Karina. I think it's Josh and Karina, but you never hear his wife on there.
Right. Well, and he's in Australia, right?
Right.
So, I mean, it would be cool, I think, to get all of us together in the same room. I'm not sure who would come out on top on that one. We'd all be talking over each other.
All right. So I'm looking here at my first episode. I went on, logged on, and it looks to me like January 23rd, 2012 was my first podcast.
There you go.
There we go.
So it's about 3 years.
Yeah.
That's cool. Well, what are some of the podcasts that that you listen to? I mean, do you listen to off topic podcasts or anything?
Well, I listen to all the sailing podcasts, the ones we've already mentioned. And
let me
open up my iPhone. I'll just look at the ones I download them, when they come available.
Right.
But let's see. There's I always listen to Car Talk, Click and Clack, the Tappa Brothers. But
okay.
They're not making anything new. A lot of investment podcasts I listen to because that's my profession.
Right, right.
There's the Escape podcast. So who's that guy?
Yeah.
The Escape Pod Sailing podcast.
Yeah.
Sail Loot, interviewed him. And let's see, for Huffington Post Weird News, that's a fun one to listen to. And
okay.
Let's see, what other ones? The Full Ratchet podcast, which is about angel investing. Again, a lot of investment podcasts that I listen to more than anything else. Then, of course, there's 59 North Sailing. And a couple of ones I really like, and I've mentioned on my podcasts, are Dan Carlin, Common Sense with Dan Carlin, and okay. Dan Carlin, Hardcore History. Those are great podcasts. Top-notch podcasts, yeah. Dan Carlin, Hardcore History. If you like, in his podcast, when he does a history podcast, they're 3, 4, 5 hours long. So wow. You can go a long time. And it's just, it's like a PhD thesis on the topic he's covering at that time. So right.
I'll have to check that one out.
Yeah. Did you ever listen to the Serial podcast?
I did listen to Serial. I didn't do it right away. I kind of waited for them all to come out at the same time when they were done, basically. And then I just kind of burned through them all in like the same week. But it was, I've listened. That was one of the, This American Life. That was one of the first other ones that I listened to back in like 2007. Basically in 2006, I had a job where I sat at a computer. So, I mean, basically working on graphic arts and they didn't mind if you had earplugs in. So you just sit there and I just kind of loaded up my iTunes with as many podcasts as I could think of. And the ones that stuck were Film Spotting for sure. And This American Life and the Planet Money and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the Kevin Smith ones. And they're the ones that I kind of keep up with now, just in terms of like comedy podcasts, I guess, something to make you laugh. The guys that do Comic Book Men are Kevin Smith's friends from childhood, and Kevin Smith, the director, owns the comic book store that they work in, and they're pretty off color, you know what I mean? But I mean, just funny, just sitting around talking and BSing and all that crazy stuff. And then when I interviewed Andy Schell, one of his big inspirations was the Nerdist podcast, which is Chris Hardwick. He's a comedian and a television host. And I've since then, I've been kind of delving into that archive. He's got over 700 episodes and he's almost like the fourth late night talk show host. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like all the people, not all, but most of the people that he gets are on the talk show circuit promoting their movie or whatever it is. But then he'll do an hour long form podcast with them and talk about whatever, you know what I mean? So they might spend 2 minutes talking about whatever movie the actor's making or whatever it is, but then they'll spend the other 58 minutes talking about whatever, you know? And just from that, I mean, what's that? 6, 7, maybe 8 kind of podcasts. I can't even keep up, I'd basically listen driving back and forth to work. I can't really listen while I'm at work. So, that and when I'm at home and then trying to do my own podcast. And then, like you said, producing podcasts is not quick or easy, and I end up listening to all my stuff. I'll listen to everything twice before I even start editing it. So, I might spend 6, 7 hours sometimes on a podcast. Sometimes it's only 2 or 3 hours, but how long do you spend on your podcasts?
Well, I'm trying to schedule them out so I can work more efficiently. I talked to Andy the other day and he's scheduled out a month at a time.
Right.
And to me, it's like trying to get one out every 2 weeks is pushing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I find it takes me almost a full day to do the editing, the writing, right. The recording. It takes really probably 8 hours to get out a podcast for me. So
right.
I'd like to be able to be more efficient. I'm going to try to work on that. But
right.
I'm pretty picky on my editing. So I go through, and in fact, I got a comment from one of my listeners said, oh, he doesn't have any ums and ahs and ahs. And that's because I go through and I told him, I said, yeah, you don't see how much that I edit out because I take those out if I can.
Well, it's pretty bad when you can tell the just by looking at the actual mm-hmm. site signature on the screen. You're like, well, that's an I'm going to delete that.
That's right. You don't even need to listen to it. You can say, oh, I recognize that pattern right there.
Exactly. And there you go. I have to edit that one out. The how did you determine your opening on your podcast? Because you have a scene from a particular movie that kind of opens your podcast.
Yeah. Actually, that I have a gate closing, the creaking of a gate closing. And the only reason I use that is I just love that sound. I think that's a cool sound. And then I have a scene from the movie Risky Business where Joel.
And you can say it. I don't care. You can.
Okay. Where Joel's buddy comes up and says, you know, Joel, sometimes you just got to say what the fuck and go for it. What the fuck gives you freedom? Freedom gives opportunity. Opportunity makes your future. And I like that opening, but what's so funny is at the end, after Joel's gone through all these crazy, crazy scenarios because he said what the fuck and went for it,
right?
Is that he gets accepted to his dream college, and his dad says, Joel, haven't I always said sometimes you got to say what the heck and go for it? Says, Dad, you are so right.
Oh, yeah, the first time I heard that, I'm like, that's awesome.
That's a great movie, you know, for a guy. My wife doesn't enjoy it that much, but I enjoy it.
So. Right. Well, and when I was, you know, kind of pre-doing my podcast, like I had bought a recorder and actually went and recorded a bunch of conversations. And it's funny because I recorded like 2 hours worth of conversation thinking that was going to be my first two episodes. But then I spent two episodes with my friend Chris, my /quote co-host, doing color commentary on that 2 hours. That was my first two podcasts, you know. And then I put a third one in there just for good measure, the people just talking on the porch. And then I finally, on the fourth episode, got around to that conversation that I had originally recorded. But I spent about a good month doing kind of the same thing. Like, what am I going to open the podcast with? You know, like there's got to be a movie quote. And I went around and like downloaded maybe 10 different movie quotes that I was like, thought might be, you know, whatever, appropriate. And then I'm like, maybe I should just put some music. And then I'm like, well, I can't just use music, you know what I mean? Because I'm reading all this stuff about licensing and don't get sued. And This American Life was talking at the time, they were talking about some patent holding company that was going to charge you to make podcasts or whatever. And I'm like, I really wanted to stick to the book. So I ended up using some music that I had created with a friend of mine that was in a band like back in the 90s. So that's my intro music. You know what I mean? But when mm-hmm. I sat down with Andy, like the first time I heard Andy's podcast and I talked to him about it, you know, his opening at the very beginning was like, hey, welcome to the 59 Degrees North podcast. And he was done in 7 seconds. And I'm like, damn it.
Yeah, you don't need to make a long lead in. In fact, you know, the podcasts I listen to, they have a long lead in. I just push that forward 15 seconds like five times to get past the opening. So
right. Now, have you I noticed you ran an ad for Andy's sailing adventures. Have you thought about like and I'm not sure how you do it, because for me, this is right now, it's just a hobby. I don't make money at it. I haven't monetized it or anything like that. Like how have you thought about doing that? Is that what you do, or are you planning on trying to do ads, or how do you work it?
Well, I think to really be sustainable, to justify your time, at some point in time, if you're giving away stuff, you have to figure a way to monetize it. I there's only so much free stuff that people are willing to do for free.
Right.
And I know I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I think that there has to be some sort of a reward other than just feeling good.
Right.
So I'm using my podcast to promote my lessons, which have not sold very well at all.
Right.
I was talking to Kim Brown about that the other day. In fact, she sent me an email that says, you know, people are starving for boats, but they're not starving for sailing education, you know. So that's not making much money.
Right.
But I think in time it may. You know, I've had good reviews in Amazon. People that listen to them are very appreciative of them.
Right.
But let me tell you, when I first got on a boat, the terminology is overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that the keelboat certification course that I have is all about terminology. And you listen to that, you're going to know what's going on when you get on a boat.
Right.
But so I'm trying to monetize it in a way. And at some point in time, if I don't feel like I'm getting enough out of it, I may just say, forget about it. You know, it's not like I'm wedded to this whole podcast thing.
Right.
But as long as it's fun, I'm meeting interesting people, and maybe like you, I'll start getting into, boat shows for free because I'm a press now. That might be fun, but there's got to be some sort of, to me,
right,
some sort of reward. Now, I'm getting that out of my Series 7. Not a lot, but a lot more than out of the sailing in the Mediterranean.
Okay.
And because I sell an audio course for training people for the Series 7 examination. And that's an examination that if you're in the industry, you have to pass. It's not arbitrary. You have to pass it. So, and it's a tough exam.
Right.
And I'm a good teacher. I'm a good audio teacher. So I do a pretty good job on that. I get emails from people all the time saying, thank you for putting that together.
Oh, that's awesome. But,
and that does that. That also goes a long ways to feeding your ego. I get emails from people saying thanks for the Sailing in the Mediterranean podcast,
but not
as many as on the other. So I'm trying to monetize it. I wouldn't mind. I've approached North Sail about sponsoring. I've approached UK about sponsoring, and I don't even get responses from them. Andy's been able to line up some sponsors, but I don't know. Now Andy also has a donate here button.
Right.
On his podcast. Now, I had a donate button on one of my early podcasts at Travel Trade Exchange, and I got absolutely zero donations, so I didn't even bother with that.
Right.
But Andy has had a few people, you know, donate a little bit of money to his podcast, he told me, and that's nice. And in fact, one of the guys that went sailing with me told me he donated some money to Andy's podcast. So I guess some people do feel like that they don't mind paying a little bit for a podcast. So.
Right.
We'll see. You know, I'm not doing it for the money, but I wouldn't mind getting some money for it.
Right.
I guess that's the way I look at it.
Yeah. And that's kind of where I'm at. Like I started it as a hobby with the thought that, you know, maybe sometime. And, for now, yeah, thanks for hanging out and talking sailing. I mean, we could talk sailing all day long and probably will at some point. But yeah, check out Franz at medsailor.com and then obviously find him on iTunes and whatnot. And go to the website and there's some videos there and you can find links to the courses that he's talking about for the ASA exams. So thanks for coming on the Shooting the Breeze podcast, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, Jeff.
All right.
Look forward to talking again.
Yep. Okay. Thanks. Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Shooting the Breeze Sailing Podcast this episode with Franz Amundsen from the Sailing in the Mediterranean podcast over at www.medsailor.com. Make sure you go check him out and, check out his study guides, like I was saying. It sounds like they're pretty interesting. For anybody who's trying to learn more about sailing, it sounds like a great way to do it. Definitely got some things going on. We got some irons in the fire, so to speak. Be heading out this weekend, hopefully, like I said, and I'll be putting up some video of this Dodger project when I'm putting it together tomorrow, and hopefully you can find that over at YouTube. Just search for Jeffrey S. Wettig,
sailing vessel Pegasus. Maybe one of these days I'll come up with a fancy schmancy YouTube name so that you can find me easier, but we'll find out about that some other point. We do have some things coming up. Like I said, I signed up to do the refit party one day with Andy Schell on the Swan 48 East Bjorn down in Annapolis, down in mid-September. And he was gracious enough to email me back and thank me for signing up and said maybe we can do some cool podcast stuff together when we're down there. So hopefully, you know, that happens. And then the beginning of October is the United States Sailboat Show, the big in-water sailboat show down in Annapolis. And I've been chatting with Kamau offline a little bit about doing a public podcast, just setting up shop on the Vrand outside of Pusser's maybe before the show one of the mornings and trying to wrangle some guests to stop by and chat about sailing and review his boat build and all that sort of stuff. So hopefully that works out. It'd be nice to do a live one and be able to set that up somehow. So I'll have to investigate that. But at the very least, have a presence down at the boat show. If anybody out there in podcast land or coming to the boat show, hit me up. I'll be down on the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, I believe. And, you know, we'll be hanging around. So maybe we can catch a coffee or a beer or something like that. Or if you have any suggestions for people for me to check out, I was just in contact with a couple people about doing interviews when they're down at the boat show. So hopefully we'll have a chock-full fall here on the Shooting the Breeze Sailing Podcast. You can find us on Facebook. We have a page, the Shooting the Breeze Sailing Podcast page. Definitely like it, share it, and check it out. You can find me on Twitter, at The Escape Pods, all one word. And I'm pretty stoked. I just got Mr. John Cryer, the actor, to retweet one of my, or favorite one of my tweets that I put out there yesterday. So Twitter's pretty fun when you get some celebrities like that you're into like that to at least stop for half a second and acknowledge your presence, you know? But anyway, you can find us there at The Escape Pods, all one word. You can get a hold of me at jeffrey.wedig@gmail.com. Send me your suggestions, your comments, your thoughts. Go over to iTunes, give us a star rating, all that fun stuff. And, you know, we'll be dishing out the content here, hopefully, for the next 6-8 weeks anyway. So thanks for listening, and we will definitely catch you on the flip side.
Hi, this is Bob Bitchin from Cruising Outpost Magazine, and you are listening to Shooting the Breeze Sailing Podcast from theescapepods.com.
This is Captain Jeffrey Wedding.
And Chris Smoker.
You're listening to the Shooting the Breeze Podcast on theescapepods.com. Sail on, brother.